The talk tonight is listening in innocence. Listening in innocence. And I want to say I always have a very deep, warm-hearted feeling for people who have made it this far into the retreat, because I know that I know what it takes personally, and having conducted so many of these, and I just, the sincerity is obvious, and I just want to thank people for making our teaching jobs so fulfilled, because it's really only fulfilled through your sincerity. So thank you. Christina's talked a little bit this morning about the art of practice, and I thought I would start off a little bit with both the science and the art. The science of the practice is that we give you a technique that has been handed down and has shown its effectiveness over the centuries, that how to steady this mind of ours, how to hold it so that it starts being able to see something, and that attention can be steadied, and eventually the power of that attention is really at your disposal. You can take it to the left or the right, or stay with the breath, whichever direction you want. But that sense of steady focus is neither wise nor unwise. In fact, if you use it and train yourself, you could become a better thief if you wanted to. And you could use it for all kinds of gains, personal gains, materialistic gains, and there are books about how to use and develop your mind for material wealth, and there are also books about how to train and use that power of samadhi for spiritual powers that are available. And it works. It works. It's a science. And there's no question that the technique pays off through its application. In fact, and I say this for all of us to have hope, that when you look at the people who have done previous residential retreats in a group, and the questions and the uncertainties and the doubts that arise within that, and then you hold a group of people who have done, say, half a dozen retreats, you see a vast difference in the degree of settledness, and the science has taken root after that number of retreats, and it pays off beneficially to that. And so the people who are new and are just organizing their lives perhaps around the practice don't know that, and seem like it's pretty hopeless from the onset. But there is a predictable way that people's lives and that this practice unfolds over time. Now, so saying, where does the art come in? Well, the application of the art is really in the intention in which we apply that samadhi. As I mentioned, you can go unwise ways, or you can go into wisdom. If you choose the direction of wisdom, which is what this meditation course and the lineage from which we teach is the direction that we point, then we're into another whole realm of art, because the essence of how to steady the mind, what do you do with it when it's once steadied? How does that translate into wisdom? And I think the word that is best representative of the skill needed for the art form to unfold into wisdom is listening. Listening. Listening often is thought of as me listening to an external object, to the sounds around me, to other people, paying attention to them as I speak. It's not often seen as the definition of meditation itself. But that is, in fact, what we are doing in meditation, is developing an inward capacity to receive or to listen to our experience. And if there is an indicator of a person's adept, their skill at meditating, it may be their ability to receive the subtlety of the sounds inwardly and externally around them. The subtlety of listening. Now, I learned much of my ability to listen at the bedside of people who were dying. In fact, I would say that the fruit of many of these years of practice that I involved myself in prior to working with the dying paid off at the bedside. Because here were patients who had nothing to lose. And there could be, and often were, a kind of nakedness in which they were willing to expose, a vulnerability in which they were willing to enter, and a questioning through which they are willing to communicate. Now, here is a relatively healthy, middle-aged man sitting at the bedside of a often very elderly person who was asking me what it was like to die. Now, how do I know that? I mean, I don't know that. And yet we were trained in our hospice ways to give the appropriate answers, and all we would ever be able to talk to them about in terms of what we knew was how people came to the point in which they died, what the physiological and often mental processes were that led to the point at which they would begin to be unable to communicate and eventually die. But people wanted more than that from us. They wanted to know what it was like to actually die. And they were wanting that not so much in terms of information. And this is where I was pulled. Because it was obvious that I hadn't died, so I wasn't really able to give them that. But what they really wanted, that I learned over time and made many, many mistakes along the way, what they were asking from me is to join them, for me to meet them, for them to have company in this inexplicable mystery that was before them. And I could see, after years of being in the service of the dying, how a newer staff people would try invariably to wiggle out of those kinds of conversations by tasking, by bringing them the medicines that they require, by bringing them the toothettes and the diapers and the bedside commode and all of the paraphernalia, but not really willing to sit by the bedside and be pulled in to that moment of pure, a pure relationship, pure attention. You see, when you're up against something like death, which is an absolute, there's a lot at stake for the person who is dying, but also the person who is attending the person who is dying. Because what an absolute does is a no-hold-barred situation where you, if you are to meet them, you're going to meet them at the point in which neither I know nor you know, in which all conversation ends. Because that's the only place to meet somebody when they're on the edge of their... What are we going to say to them? What are we going to offer them? You can't offer them. I mean, it's all over. They don't care about who's winning the World Series. And that is the most uncomfortable place that I ever was and have been. Uncomfortable because it forced my own mortality to arise within that absolute. So what both of us met, where we met in our listening was at our mortality, was within our mortality. What does that mortality look like? I don't know. That's what it looks like. And your mind screams. My mind screamed at not having a way to circumvent that very uncomfortable place where I cannot offer you anything more. In Thailand, the word for understanding is khao jai, entering the heart, entering the heart. And understanding is a byproduct of listening. Now, how does something enter the heart? Only awareness has access to the door of the heart. Pure awareness. Pristine awareness. Add anything to the awareness, any judgment, any condemnation, any leaning, any aversion, and the door of the heart snaps closed. And you're left with an opinion, but not the gateway, not the rotundra of the heart, not the gateway. And so you begin to understand, and I, as in my, because I was also teaching meditation, even as I was working with hospice patients, I began to extrapolate that bedside interaction to other people who were well, who were healthy, and wondering why, what is it? Where is that moment with the healthy? It's harder to find only because the healthy doesn't see their life in terms of an absolute. They see it as terms of a continuation. They see it as something that's going to go on, not as something that's going to end abruptly. And when we think about the lives, our lives continuing on, then we have to hold to a kind of image of that continuation. And so there's often a kind of distortion that goes through the relationship that carries the need to have the image continue and the projection from that image, which wasn't there, often was not there, when you work with somebody who knew that their image, because their mind and body, were going to stop. So how to listen to that? Now, as I speak about listening, please don't think of it as merely an external thing. This is, apply it to ourselves. How do I listen to myself in the sense, in the, you see, when we listen to ourselves, we think of ourselves as continuing on. And so we have a lot of reluctance to be committed to hearing ourselves completely because we've heard this moaning and this groaning and this complaining and this posturing and this. And if you do enough meditation, after you've done enough retreating, you get the whole panorama view of the mind's workings, and it's like repetitious. And it gets to the point where you wish it would shut up, but it doesn't seem to be able to. And that sense of inward listening from a sense of continuity of myself keeps us from really being full embodied in our listening, keeps us from really looking critically, meeting critically at that place where I don't know what this mind is about. Because we've heard it and it's going to continue on and it's just babbling and I'm so tired of it and so sick of it and I know it's going to be there the next sitting. And that sense of it going on foreverness some way hedges our ability to arrive at that crucial point where we can really invest in our listening. We can really listen to ourselves critically from the not knowing place. From the not knowing place. Now, it's very interesting. Now, I just want you to... The point of meditation, there are two things that are happening simultaneously. There's this continuation theme. That is when the bell rings. All that means the sitting is over. You see the continuation of thing. The bell ringing doesn't mean it's for itself. It's not the ringing for itself. It means something in relationship to the next thing I have to do. It means that I can stop sitting now and get up. And it's that continuation, that will, that inviting things to pull us along in time that keeps us from seeing or hearing something in absolute terms. Do you see that? That doesn't mean anything except that. That is death. And that is pure listening. But when we listen from the context of the next thing, which is how we often listen to ourselves, oh, anger again, I've been, I had such a trouble with this and the history, and what am I going to do with it? Well, I've got to find a way around this thing, or my whole meditation is just going to be angry filled, or my pain, or my lethargy, or my loneliness. See, it all has something to do with the embellishment and continuation of our image. And may I say, and this is this is the prime what does Star Trek say? The prime prime directive. The prime directive. Thank you, Star Trekker. The prime directive of the mind. The prime directive of the mind is self-preservation at all cost. Is self-preservation. Survival of the image. That is how it's organized. That's its point, its purpose, is to organize the illogical, unknown, and mysterious universe into packaged, knowable quantities, so we can navigate through it and survive that navigation in terms of protection. And when that sense of self-preservation is no longer about getting up the tree so the lion won't eat us, it becomes entwined with our image, an image of self-preservation. So our image is what needs to be preserved. And so what it will lead with throughout our meditation is its continuation of theme. And everything we hear, and everything we smell, and everything we taste. The dance of preserving myself continues in front of our eyes. When we sit down, what do we see? We see the middle of a movie. We don't see the beginning or the opening shots. We see what we have lived with our whole difficult life. and where we're going to have to go next or whatever. And it's that loss of innocence, that loss of hearing things for itself, which the mind directly works against to keep us continuous, to keep the sense of you and I continuous. So what, you say? Why are you asking me so what? That is the problem. That is the source of stress, of anger, of difficulty, of angst, of conflict, of turmoil. The inability to listen free of that theme of everlasting. And we project in order for us to have the right ingredients for my image to form and for the embodiment and empowerment of that image, we project out from the mind things we don't like onto other situations, people, and events. And therefore, we recoil when we see those other events and people at those very things that we have projected out from our own mind. It's so interesting. I used to have this happen to me where out of nothing, I would be sitting and I would just open my eyes and I'd be angry. Nothing occurred that caused that anger. At least I couldn't see any conditions. The conditions were that it just arose based on whatever. But because I needed something to fight, anger itself was not okay for me to feel, I looked out and invested the anger in how the person next to me was wiggling, or the person behind me was coughing, or the color of the clothes of the person in front of me. That gave it legitimacy. That gave it something that I could really fight against. Because what the sense of me, the sense of image, loves is that being contested, being in conflict, having a rub. Even though it's a projection out from our own mind, never mind. We fight against it. It gives us a sense of purpose, meaning, intentionality. It gives us an embodied spirit, a protagonist and an antagonist. It gives us a story. It gives us a script. It gives us everything. How does that happen? From our own projections. To make it very clear, I was with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross when she was alive many years ago, and she told the following story. She said, She was talking to a 23-year-old mother of four children, and she was dying. The 23-year-old mother was dying. She was dying of cancer. And Elizabeth asked the audience, she said, now how would you feel if you came into the room of a 23-year-old dying mother of four? One newborn infant was one of the four. And people said, well, I'd be enraged. How unfair it is. I would be fearful for her. I would be pitying the situation. I would be grieving what the children must be feeling. And Elizabeth said, wait a second, you see. All of you are relating to her illness. None of you are relating to her. And that, in fact, is what the 23-year-old woman said. Everyone that comes in the door has a reaction to what I'm going through. No one wants to connect with me. That sense of projection becomes almost uniform when we sit. We look out and we are angry at the things that our mind, the coloration of our mind in that moment. Have you noticed that today? It really has nothing to do with the experiences at hand. It has nothing to do with the events within our life. It has to do with our unwillingness to listen to our emotional life and let it be complete in and of itself. The feeling is, the image is, I can't work with this anger. This anger doesn't fit my self-image. And therefore, I have to put it outside of me so somebody else can hold the anger, and then I can reel and react to them. So the anger doesn't represent itself. It represents the continuity of the theme and idealization of me that can only sustain itself if it is not thought of as being an angry person. Do you see that? It doesn't leave us much room. And we can begin to see that our ability to hear, our ability to listen to ourselves is constantly colored with a projected, opinionated screening, so that we only allow in what we listen. When we listen to something, we only allow in what fits our opinion. And therefore, we end up listening to our own voice. Everything else is denied or rejected. And that is all very true when we start tuning into ourself, start tuning into the messages of ourself. We only let the messages in that fit the image that's appropriate. Nothing else gets in. Nothing else is allowed to say anything. You know, one of the hardest things, one of the hardest relationships to have is our relationship with pain. Because pain means so much about our own self-embodiment. It might mean that we're growing old, or it might remind us of an old scarring or abuse or an old injury. Or it might remind us of how weak we fear we are. And our lack of courage, our lack of self-esteem. It could mean how terrible the practice is going, and thereby implicate a terrible practitioner who is suffering, and how they're not up to the task of the meditation. It rarely means itself. We meet pain with our history of dental appointments and falls and sprained knees. But do we ever let it mean itself? Just what it is. Just listening to what it is, letting it rest not in the continuation of the imaginary, the pull along of the continuous, but the sound it's making, signifying only itself, feeling pain as a vertical statement rather than as a horizontal continuation. Just as listening to the bell, we listen to it just as the bell, just the sound, rather than for an ending of something or the beginning of something else. To listen to it as a vertical statement, as a thing of itself, is the transcendence that all things offer. Everything can represent the same thing, the continuation, or it can represent itself. Are we willing to listen, to see, to smell, to taste, to feel, to think, and allow those things to be for themselves, of themselves? To do so, we cannot meet what we listen to with opinions. Opinions are convenient walls or blockages to the unknown. When we listen with our opinionation, we are pulling ourselves along to protect ourselves from the unknown of just what that thing means without an opinion. Because what it means without an opinion is nothing. It means nothing without an opinion. And that nothing is too strong. It's too infinite. It's too absolute. So we bring our opinions in so that the theme can be a continuation and thereby pull ourselves through by holding on to our opinion rather than by seeing the thing stand alone. Is that getting in? The Dharma is to stand naked. The Dharma is to stand with the thing meaning just what it does. Which is what? Which is what? You see, you have a choice. We can look around the room and everything means something about the situation that the retreat we're in, perhaps how much longer we have to go, what time of day it is. It can mean about everything. And it does. It holds the fabric of recognition and memory associated with all the sense doors. Now we can stop it there, or we can free ourselves up from the hold that that meaning has upon our consciousness and also allow it to mean only what it is. And it doesn't mean that we start walking into walls because we no longer have the meaning of a wall as opposed to a door. No, that's still there. It's just that it rests very comfortably in what we don't know. And then the world becomes wondrous. Our breath becomes wondrous. The pain in the knee becomes wondrous. And it's not all about fixing, because fixing is only when there's something broken on the continuation of the theme that must be surmounted so that I can get on with something. So nothing is ever broken. Nothing ever needs fixing. And that is listening from death. That is listening to the world in a very different way. It's very easy to slip back. My mind is organized as a fixer. I like to fix things. If there's a problem, I like the solution. If there is a difficulty, I like to get over the problem and get on with it. That's how my mind is organized. My wife's mind is a processor. She doesn't want to be fixed. She just wants to be heard. So now you have somebody who wants to be heard and somebody who wants to fix. And you put them together in communication. And there isn't one. There's no communication. Because she wants to have me hear her and I just want to fix the problem and move on. The hearing isn't what's important. It's taken me a long time to learn that I'm from Mars and she's from Venus. It's taken me a long time to learn that. And so now, because the impulse to fix is always there, because oftentimes when we communicate at any length of time, there's some problem that arises. And I see the solution immediately, but I have learned after 18 years of being with her, okay, just let it go. Let the solution go. Try to meet her where she wants to be met. And you know, I'm rarely, even now, successful at being able to do that. It's that strong. So I'm not saying this is an easy thing for us to listen differently. I'm saying the potential is there. Every time we look. And for some of us, the first time we look, we're best able to do that because we don't have the history of having looked before. The first time we sit down in meditation and go, what's going on here? Is a legitimate interface with the unknown. We don't know. Unfortunately, we want to find out rather than just sit there in that difficult place in which I really don't know what's going on. And so then we have to traverse perhaps years and years and years of meditation so that we can come back to that very first time we ever sat and then be able to hold comfortably what's going on here. Isn't it an amazing trip? It's an amazing journey. So much of the journey requires a kind of trust. Listening requires a trusting. We don't trust it, not knowing. We have often had a history of mistrust. We've had when we didn't have the power of discernment, things got thrown back at us and we were in disarray through our naive trusting. Think perhaps we were abused or manipulated, and we've been scarred sufficiently so that the word trust isn't a word of safety. It's a word of insecurity, really. And yet listening rests on trust. Listening rests on trust. Perhaps we have given up. If we trust anything, we trust our own empowerment, our ability to empower ourselves. And I'm not giving myself away. That's not empowerment. And yet listening requires giving over our power. Listening requires giving up our power of knowing, our power of certainty. So how is it that we can ever learn to listen and trust at the same time when listening is about disempowerment and trust is about empowerment? We do it very cautiously. We do it one step at a time. We have to build trust back into the system, which is one of the reasons it feels as if the spiritual journey takes so long. We have to look around and prove for ourselves that this moment is trustworthy. Not where this moment is going, but this moment in itself can be held. This moment can be fully experienced. This moment can be fully listened to without having to know too much about it. And we see that time and time again when we open our eyes. We feel the safety within the immediacy, within the now of the experience. Not the fact that I have to walk next period and the walking is so, I hate walking and it's raining and the wind's blowing and what am I going to do? How can I get out of it? I'll go have tea. He'll never know. She'll never know. Because that's not now. You don't trust that. You trust now. Is now workable? Are we capable of holding the experience of now, whatever that experience might be, as itself, not where it's going to lead, not what it means in relationship to my image, but now. Can I hold now? If I can hold now, then now takes care of the next moment. And so I learn to trust in my capacity to hold experience. Not hold on. Allow experience. To allow experience to be. I had a friend who said to me, I don't think I've ever loved. In fact, he poo-pooed love. He said, I think it's a kind of a romantic thing, and I don't really believe in it. And we were going away. He lives next door, so we gave him our cat to keep. And we have a very wonderful cat. At least I think. Christina might not, because she has to visit us with our cat. But I like our cat. Anyway, so we gave our cat to our neighbor, and the neighbor, when we came back, said that one time he was petting our cat, and he just felt this warming of the heart. And he realized that he could trust his capacity to love, that he had that capacity, that he had never known it before. You see, we're always trusting something. Mostly, we're trusting our contraction, our defensiveness. We're trusting our disempowerment, really. We're entrusting our defensiveness. We're entrusting our own sense of accomplishment, our own sense of being able to do. We don't feel that the moment can offer us much. If anything, it depletes our own empowerment. It depletes our own sense of worth, which it does. But to the beautiful enhancement of our love, we give away one, we get the other. And so what we ultimately have to trust in our listening is that love takes care of this thing. That awareness on its own has the final statement. That we don't have to make it or do it. So we develop faith. Faith in our ability to listen. Faith in our ability to feel the pain, to feel the emotion, to embody ourselves. Faith in the willingness to receive our experience without opinionating and holding it at bay through our ideas, through our objections. But to let it in, and it's safe letting it in. And that it doesn't mean something about me, that it means something for itself, which never is about me. This is what we learn. This is how we learn to listen, in innocence. Not as sophisticated meditators. There's nothing more obnoxious than a sophisticated meditator. Because they've made a right turn from wisdom. I guess that's a left turn. I'm tired of words. I'm tired of people being able to talk the good line. Christina was pointing to it today. This is about integration. The integration of faith, the integration of listening. The willingness to relax into that listening without needing protection. Therein lies the innocence of freedom. Therein lies the gift of safety. Not in the self-protective theme, but in our open expanse to listening. So we sit. How do we sit? Knowing that the art and science of practice both works, the science will allow us to attend. We can train ourselves to attend. But how are we going to attend? How are we going to listen? How will we be present? Will it continue the theme? Or will it be clear, innocent listening to the thing itself, for the thing itself? That's available to us. that is a product of sincerity, not of effort and not of training. Sincerity. What do we really want from this? Because we will seek a way to find what we really want. And if we want an open heart, then it will be through the innocence the kaujai, the entering the heart of our listening. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two?